Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend. And I want to say first off, I appreciate everyone reaching out after last week's listener feedback episode when a fan of the show named Steven asked us to look into a Commerce Clause case. I'm decently confident that Steven is a law student, even though he didn't say so. Who else would ask a question about the Commerce Clause? And it's possible he had just received a syllabus and found out that he would have to write a con law midterm at some point on the Commerce Clause. So I hope we could help him out. But I do appreciate everyone who reaches out. It really does mean a lot to me and makes me want to continue this strange hobby I've found myself diving into. In this episode, we're going to do a little more in-depth on mental illness, how it affects criminal prosecutions, when it applies, when it doesn't. We're also going to discuss premeditation and plea bargaining. Those topics are going to come out in a really exceptional case. Today's subject has been called the first true jihadist in America. American history has had plenty of political assassinations, but few have enshrined their place like this one. In the very early morning hours of June 5th, 1968, one of the most famous senators in America had just finished giving a nationally televised speech at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, California. This man had just claimed victory in the California primary for the 68 presidential Democratic nomination. He walked off the podium in the main ballroom, down through the kitchen. His entourage included bodyguards, journalists, campaign staff, and hotel employees guiding the way. He was preparing to meet an army of reporters in the next room. Towards the end of the kitchen, a young man emerged, unnoticed. He walked right into the senator's retinue, pulled out a .22 caliber pistol. Three bullets hit the senator, one hitting him in the head. A number of people immediately jumped on the young man and wrestled the gun out of his hand and subdued him. The following day, Robert F. Kennedy was declared dead at Good Samaritan Hospital. And this is the State of California versus Sirhan Sirhan. Over time, the name Sirhan Sirhan has lost some of its power. But if you lived through the 60s and 70s, there was no question you knew who Sirhan Sirhan was, what he did, and had read the tomes of articles, journals, and essays about why he did it. Now, to understand why Sirhan Sirhan shot Robert Kennedy at the Ambassador Hotel, you really need a true understanding of who Sirhan Sirhan was. That is, of course, a factor of his life, his upbringing, his values, and the things he considered of the utmost importance. Sirhan Bishara Sirhan was born March 19, 1944, in Jerusalem, what is now Israel. But in 1944, there was no state of Israel. His parents were Arab Christians who lived in the Mishrara neighborhood of the city. As a child, Sirhan witnessed a good deal of ethnic violence and was traumatized while he was young, as he watched a military vehicle swerving to avoid gunfire run over his older brother, killing him. The sight haunted him his entire life. He ultimately became a Jordanian citizen when Jordan annexed the West Bank. Desperate to leave the Middle East and the violence, Sirhan's father, Bishara, and mother, Mary, moved to the United States and ultimately settled in Pasadena, California, when Sirhan was 12. He attended junior high, then high school in Pasadena, and then went to Pasadena City College. Sirhan had a fairly difficult relationship with his father, who was a stern man who used corporeal punishment frequently to make his points to his children. Bishara left the family to go back to the Middle East not long after the family had settled in California. Sirhan's teen years and early adulthood were a bit aimless. He was very slight, standing only 5'5" tall and weighing 120 pounds, so he took a job trying to become a jockey working at a stable. But he was injured in an accident and suffered head trauma, so he quit. He did hold various other odd jobs for short periods of time, but nothing that really lasted. The one constant in his life was his devotion to God and religion. Sirhan would be classified as a devout man during his formative years. He had grown up strict Christian, though when he moved out on his own, he did vacillate between various church denominations. At one point, he joined a Baptist church, and then he became a Seventh-day Adventist. But ultimately, Sirhan joined what was called the Ancient Mystical Order of the Rose Cross. And trust me, this is a real thing. They're a branch of a larger group called the Rosicrucians. The Ancient Mystical Order of the Rose Cross, or AMORC, has three basic categories of teachings called the Postulant, Neophyte, and Initiate sections. It's a mystical religion, which deals with metaphysics, parapsychology, comparative religion, biology, extrasensory perception, alchemy, medicine, divine symbolism, and spiritual divination. The AMORC followers believe that certain actions, especially certain sacrifices, can cause more and more complete unity with the divine, and this will become a little more important later, so keep it in mind. In 1964, Sirhan was 20 years old. He was enrolled in Pasadena City College, working some odd jobs on the side after his head injury took being a jockey off the table. And again, he was devoutly religious. It's around this time that he starts to fall in with vocal anti-Zionist and anti-Israel groups. Sirhan had never really processed the trauma of watching his brother get killed. He began to vocally oppose Israel, calling it an oppressive state in the Middle East. He claimed Israel was increasingly violent towards the Palestinian population within its own borders and towards the greater Arab population in the neighboring countries. His anti-Israel sentiments moved from a vocal opposition to activism after the Six-Day War in June 1967. Sirhan believed that Israel had illegitimately seized control of the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and Old City Jerusalem from Palestinians. Sirhan became increasingly enmeshed in both his political activism and his religious fervor. Through AMORC, he felt that he was being given divine knowledge and inspiration. He felt that it was his duty to act on behalf of God's will, which was to oppose Israel. He felt called to sacrifice in order to truly follow his anti-Zionist views. 1968 was a presidential election year. The Republican nominee was former Vice President Richard Nixon. Nixon had served under President Eisenhower. A number of individuals were vying for the Democratic ticket in that spring and summer. There were three candidates who were the frontrunners: Eugene McCarthy, Hubert Humphrey, and Robert Kennedy. As the spring and early summer came, states began to hold their primaries, and each candidate was trying to win as many state primaries as possible. California, as the holder of a massive number of electoral votes, was a significant step in securing the ticket. Senator Robert Kennedy won California and was on track to become the Democratic candidate for president. He was in Los Angeles when the winner of the primary was declared, staying at the Ambassador Hotel. Late at night, on June 4, 1968, as he was declared the primary winner, Kennedy gave a speech in the main ballroom of the hotel. Shortly after midnight, now June 5th, he was escorted from the dais of the ballroom out through the kitchen entrance. Some campaign staffers and reporters and security and hotel staff were moving him from the ballroom to another conference room where he was planning a press conference and would take questions from reporters. Spirits were high as a California win was a huge addition and a big step towards the nomination. Everyone was talking, and nobody noticed that a short, slight Palestinian man had worked his way into the far entrance of the kitchen, walked around the edge of the room, and was approaching the group from behind. Nobody noticed that he took a path straight towards Kennedy. Nobody noticed when he drew out a .22 caliber Ivor Johnson cadet revolver. Nobody noticed until it was too late. Kennedy was shot three times, once in the head and twice in the back. Sirhan also shot Paul Schrade, a union official, William Weisel, TV producer for ABC, Ira Goldstein, who was a reporter, Elizabeth Evans, who is a friend of one of Kennedy's campaign aides, and Erwin Stroll, a teenager volunteering on the campaign. The other five individuals all mercifully survived. Sirhan was tackled by authors George Plimpton, Jimmy Breslin, and Pete Hamill, who were aided by professional football player Rosie Greer and Olympic gold medalist Rafer Johnson. The shooting took place on the one-year anniversary to the day of the start of the Six-Day War. After he'd been subdued, Sirhan stated to the group, "I did it for my country." Kennedy was rushed to Good Samaritan Hospital while the country held its collective breath for a full day before he was declared dead early on June 6th. It will come as no great surprise that Sirhan was arrested at the scene. He was identified by every member of the group who was with Kennedy and was kept in an isolated holding cell at the local police station while the press went ballistic. On June 9th, Sirhan was put on tape and questioned by the LAPD. He made a lengthy recorded confession. The killing was all anyone could talk about in the month of June. After California, it seemed that Kennedy, a popular senator and brother of assassinated President John F. Kennedy less than 5 years earlier in November of 63, was a strong contender to win the 68 presidential election. And now he had suffered the same tragic fate as his brother. You'll remember from previous episodes that murder is a state crime. Even though Kennedy was a national figure working for the federal government, Sirhan's actions violated the California state prohibition of murder, and thus the case went to the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office and not to the United States Attorney's Office. Now, the district attorney at the time was Evel Younger. Now, if you're a fan of the show, and I sincerely hope that you are, you'll recall that a previous episode featured the Charles Manson trial, which also took place in Los Angeles County in close temporal proximity, just a few years after this case. Younger was the district attorney for both cases. You probably can't even imagine the years of his life that being the DA of LA County during those times must have taken off. Younger selected Lynn Buck Compton to be the lead prosecutor. Compton was a World War II vet of the famed Easy Company, which was featured if you ever saw the HBO miniseries Band of Brothers. Assisting Compton was David Fitz. The defense team consisted of lead attorney Grant Cooper, who was backed up by Emil Berman. The judge on the case was the Honorable Herbert Walker, a sharp-witted cynic with a dry sense of humor, who would occasionally slip past professionalism to make a point in his courtroom. Now, Cooper had a problem. His client had murdered one of the most high-profile men in America in a room full of people and then made a full taped confession to the police. Based on the nature of the crime and his conversations with Sirhan, Cooper quickly decided to pursue an insanity defense. The current California insanity defense statute has the same requirements as the federal system and a significant percentage of other states, New York being one. There are two main considerations to the insanity defense. The first is the elements, and the second is the standard by which you have to prove them. So, the current elements of the insanity defense in California is that a person can be considered mentally ill or deficient to the point where they cannot be held criminally liable for their actions when they either cannot appreciate the nature or consequences of their actions or when they do not know that their actions are wrong. Always remember that this applies to the actions at the time of the criminal behavior. You cannot become insane after a crime was committed and use that as a defense. Also, you cannot have an ongoing condition which is episodic, but commit the crime during a lucid period and claim insanity. The condition must be in place at the exact time when the behavior at issue occurred. Here's some quick examples to illustrate this. Let's say that Max is a germaphobe and a dust freak, and he experiences a psychotic break while living alone in his apartment. In his delusional state, he believes that his neighbor, Brendan, has borrowed his vacuum cleaner and Clorox wipes. Max breaks into Brendan's apartment, takes his vacuum cleaner and wipes, and returns to his apartment. Brendan calls the police, and Max is arrested. At a trial, if Max can show that at the time he believed that the items were his because of his delusion, then he's not criminally liable for burglary and theft because he could not appreciate the nature of his actions. He believed he was retrieving his own items, while in reality, he was taking the property of someone else. Here's another example. Let's say that Tom is a paranoid schizophrenic. While experiencing an episode, Tom begins to believe that John Paul is plotting to murder him. So Tom attacks John Paul. Tom was incapable of appreciating that his actions were wrong at the time of the attack because he legitimately believed he was acting in self-defense. One very interesting question I get a lot about insanity revolves around intoxication. When people are extremely inebriated, they sometimes will create false beliefs and then act on those beliefs. Now, does that constitute insanity? And the answer is no. Being really drunk is not considered a mental disease or defect under the law. it may create other avenues for defense regarding the mental state required to commit a crime, but that's for another episode. It is not an insanity defense. The second consideration here is the standard. An insanity defense has to be established by a preponderance of the evidence. That's the standard, preponderance. That means the jury has to find it's 51% likely to be true, or simply that it's more likely true than not true. This is a much lower standard than beyond a reasonable doubt, which defense attorneys frequently will remind jurors. So that's the current standard for insanity in California. It's difficult to establish, and it fails to cover a significant number of afflictions, which most people would agree should be covered under the insanity defense. But this incident took place prior to 1982, where California shifted to that standard. Before 1982, there was one additional way that a person could argue criminal insanity. That was called diminished capacity. Again, California no longer recognizes this, but at the time it was a valid defense, and it's that that Cooper indicated he planned to argue on Sirhan's behalf. To establish that a person has a diminished capacity, the defendant has to show that due to, again, a mental disease or defect, he was unable to form the specific intent or premeditation to commit the crime at the time when the act occurred. For example, to convict of first-degree murder in California, the prosecutor needs to prove that the defendant acted with malice aforethought. If a person suffered from diminished capacity, it would mean that they were not mentally capable of harboring malice, and thus the defendant couldn't be convicted of murder. Diminished capacity only applies to crimes which require a specific intent or a specific state of mind for the defendant to commit them. Crimes which simply require that the defendant commit the act itself are not subject to a diminished capacity defense. Cooper planned to argue that Sirhan was mentally ill and suffering from a diminished capacity and thus could not be guilty of first-degree murder. In any event, proving insanity is very hard. Few cases where a criminal defendant asserts an insanity defense will actually lead to a finding that the defendant is not responsible for their actions. It nearly never happens when there is no prior diagnosis of mental disease from before the action which resulted in the defendant's arrest. Jurors typically conclude that this is a fabricated way to try and avoid jail. And even in cases where there is a documented history of mental disease, convincing a jury that the person was under the influence of their mental disease at the exact moment in question is often difficult. A lot of considerations are brought before the jury, and the determination is highly contextual. Prosecutors and defense attorneys argue different interpretations of the evidence to support their ultimate conclusions, one being that the defendant knew exactly what they were doing and what the consequences would be, and the other being that the person either couldn't appreciate the nature and consequences or simply didn't know that what they were doing was wrong at the time. We'll get into this a little bit more later when discussing the trial evidence. There are a lot of legal requirements a defendant has to meet in order to argue an insanity defense. There are strict time limits by which the defense attorney has to provide notice to the prosecutor and the court of the intention to make this argument. The reason for that is that we don't want defendants to spring a complicated defense strategy on a prosecutor on the eve of trial. In the spirit of fairness and due process, if a defense attorney intends to call a mental health professional, whether it be a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a social worker or whoever, to testify about a defendant's mental condition, then the prosecutor is given the opportunity to have their own expert evaluate the defendant and generate their own opinion about his or her condition. So Sirhan's attorney let the DA's office know that they planned to say that Sirhan was suffering from a severe mental disease at the time of the incident, and that due to that disease, he was unable to form the specific intent necessary due to a diminished capacity. Now, there was intense pressure and scrutiny surrounding this case, so no time was wasted at all, and the case was fast-tracked. Pre-trial issues were resolved very quickly. By the following February, a mere 8 months after the incident, the case was set for trial. 8 months is an extremely short period for a murder case, especially a high-profile murder case, and especially when a complex affirmative defense like mental disease is being asserted. And the trial itself almost didn't even take place. 2 days prior to when the trial was scheduled to begin jury selection, Compton, Cooper, and their respective teams, and Sirhan, met with Judge Walker in his chambers. Sirhan addressed Judge Walker directly. He explained to the judge that the lawyer and the prosecutor had worked out a deal where he would plead to murder in the first degree with the understanding that he would receive life in prison instead of the death penalty. Now, this is the type of negotiated case resolution that happens on a daily basis in courts all over the country. At this point, very few cases actually wind up going to trial. And when a defendant is willing to plead guilty to murder in the first degree, that's typically going to be the end of it. Now let's take a moment and discuss how a plea bargain actually works. Now, this is a topic which a lot of people have a basic understanding of, but where the actual process is a little obscure. In the United States, a lot of people are arrested every single day, far more than the court system could possibly handle trials for. To deal with this, prosecutors and defense attorneys engage in plea bargaining. The defendant will agree to plead guilty and save the prosecutor the time, energy, and resources of putting a trial together, and in return, the defendant typically will get either a lesser charge or at the very least consideration in terms of sentence. That's typically where most people's knowledge base of plea bargaining ends, but there's a little more to it. Those of you who listened to the episode on General Michael Flynn well, remember, we covered this topic a bit there also, so if you want additional information, you can always go back and listen to that. There's another element to plea bargaining. It's often a rubber stamp or a pro forma step, but it can have a significant impact on the case once every blue moon. The judge has to sign off on the deal. The judge has the authority to reject a plea bargain if he or she feels that the terms are manifestly unjust or are an affront to the justice system. If somehow a defendant who's accused of murder was being offered a plea to disorderly conduct, which is a slap on the wrist, a judge is likely to question why such a significant departure is being offered. If the judge isn't satisfied that the answer is good enough, the court can reject the plea and force the parties to go to trial. Judges are not required to state the reasons for why they reject a plea, though it's usually pretty obvious. When Sirhan and Cooper met with Compton in Judge Walker's chambers, and Sirhan offered to plead guilty to murder and accept a life sentence, both sides believed the case was effectively over. But this was not a typical case. Judge Walker rejected the plea and instructed the parties to get ready for trial. At first, this decision by Judge Walker really perplexed me. Sirhan was offering to plead guilty to the top count as long as the state of California agreed not to seek the death penalty. That could hardly be considered too generous a gift. After a lot of research, I came across a summary of an interview that Judge Walker gave later in his life where he talked about the Sirhan case. He talked about the plea which was brought and explained why he refused to take it. John F. Kennedy had been assassinated on November 22, 1963, about 4.5 years prior to Robert Kennedy suffering the same fate. The man who most people believe was responsible, Lee Harvey Oswald, was himself killed before any meaningful justice could be sought, and the country was left with nothing but questions, uncertainty, and confusion. Judge Walker was determined that this Kennedy's death would have finality that he felt the country needed, so he wanted a full public trial. And I can't say that I blame him. The trial began on February 12, 1969. Both sides made compelling opening arguments and gave their predictions as to what the evidence was going to show to the jury. Cooper maintained that Sirhan was suffering from a severe mental illness at the time of the shooting and suffered from a diminished mental capacity as a result. The centerpiece of Cooper's defense was Dr. Bernard Diamond, a professor of law and psychiatry at the University of California at Berkeley, who testified that Sirhan had exhibited signs of diminished capacity at the time of the shooting. A quick note about expert testimony in criminal cases. In the real world, as opposed to what you see on Law and Order, experts cannot testify as to the ultimate question of guilt or innocence, so the defense witness cannot testify that during the commission of the crime, the defendant's actual mental state was in the midst of a psychotic break or an active delusion, and that he could not understand the nature and consequences, or that at the time he did not have his full capacity. Conversely, the prosecution expert cannot affirmatively state that, based on their examination of the defendant to a degree of medical certainty, that at the time of the commission of the crime, he was lucid and sane. And that's because only the jury gets to make the ultimate decision on the facts. What you will actually see will be something like the following. The defense psychologist will testify that they've reviewed the records and met with the defendant, and based on their review of all the materials, they're aware that the defendant has been a paranoid schizophrenic for years. He's been actively seeking treatment. He's had several documented episodes of psychotic breaks when he doesn't take his medication. These breaks take the form of flat affect, irrational behavior, disorganized speech, lack of impulse control, paranoia, and violent outbursts. And the records reflect that at the time of the incident, that the defendant had been off his medications for about a month. It's then the job of the defense attorney to tie that testimony in with other descriptions of his client's behavior to show that at the time of the alleged crime, the defendant had a flat affect, irrational behavior, disorganized speech, lack of impulse control, paranoia, and violent outbursts. That allows him to argue to the jury that the only logical conclusion here is that the client was in the midst of a psychotic break at the time of the alleged crime. The psychologist cannot testify that the defendant was in the middle of a psychotic break when the crime was committed and therefore is not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. In the Sirhan trial, Dr. Diamond testified extensively about mental illness, about diminished capacity specifically, how it can manifest, the types of associated behaviors, how mental illness can build over time before it causes a break with reality, and how a break can result in seemingly outrageous conduct. Perhaps Cooper's best evidence that Sirhan was mentally ill was the nature of the crime itself. Cooper passionately argued that nobody in their right frame of mind would sneak into a hotel, sneak up on one of the most famous men in the entire country, and gun him down in front of an entire room with literally thousands of people in the hotel with absolutely no plan to escape. The nature of the act demonstrated that an irrational mind was at play and that it was using diminished faculties. Cooper wanted the jury to see that Sirhan was a man suffering from real mental issues who was unable to resist a sudden impulse to shoot Kennedy. That wouldn't be murder because it lacked premeditation or malice aforethought. For being dealt a lousy hand in terms of cards to play for defense, Cooper was doing a pretty impressive job. But Compton and the prosecution team was ready for this argument and systematically destroyed it. When you're a prosecutor and you have a case that gets any media attention whatsoever, you have to make sure your investigation is airtight. And when it's literally the biggest trial that decade, you cross every T and dot every I 100 times over. David Fitz delivered the prosecution's opening statement. He explained the state's case coolly and calmly. He explained exactly what evidence of premeditation the jury was going to hear. Here's a synopsis of the highlights, the state's evidence, and why they claimed malice aforethought was clearly shown. Sirhan was seen at the Ambassador Hotel on June 3rd, 1968, 2 nights before the shooting, learning the building's layout. The following day, June 4th, Sirhan visited a gun range to practice pistol shooting. Alvin Clark, Sirhan's garbage collector, testified that roughly a month prior to the shooting, Sirhan had told him of his intention to kill Kennedy, specifically by shooting him. Judge Walker also allowed the prosecution to admit pages from multiple journals that Sirhan had kept where he talked about killing Kennedy for his support of Israel. Piece by piece, the prosecution showed that Sirhan had been planning to kill Kennedy and that this was no sudden impulse. Even the specific day was meaningful. It was the 1-year anniversary of the beginning of the Six-Day War, which Sirhan had written about extensively in his journals. As an anti-Zionist, Sirhan was incensed that Kennedy had promised 50 fighter jets to Israel if he was elected president. There was a journal entry from May 18th, 1968, which read, quote, My determination to eliminate RFK is becoming the more and more of an unshakable obsession. Kennedy must die before June 5th, end quote. Cooper could see that the evidence for premeditation was pretty strong, so he had the conversation with Sirhan about testifying, and Sirhan indicated that indeed he wished to testify. The day Sirhan was supposed to take the stand, nobody was prepared for what happened. Before the jury came in, but while the courtroom was still packed with media, the judge asked the parties, as is routine, if there was anything to discuss before bringing the jury into the courtroom. Before Cooper could indicate that the defense was ready to proceed, Sirhan stood up and proclaimed before the whole courtroom that he again wished to change his plea to guilty and that he wished to discharge his lawyers. Moderately amused and perhaps a bit unprofessionally, Judge Walker addressed him directly and asked him what he intended to do about sentencing if he accepted a plea. Sirhan answered, "I will ask to be executed." At first, the courtroom was silent enough to hear a pin drop. Then a number of things happened in rapid succession. First, Judge Walker denied the request and indicated the trial would proceed. Second, Cooper and Berman requested that the judge entertain a motion for them to be relieved of counsel, as they felt they could no longer represent Sirhan and had had a communication breakdown which could not be fixed. That, too, was denied. Then there was an absolute flood of journalists tearing out of the courtroom in a stampede in search of the nearest payphone. Judge Walker finally settled the courtroom, and Sirhan took the stand. On direct, Sirhan admitted that he killed Kennedy, but claimed that he bore the man no ill will and had no malice towards him. Part of Cooper's strategy was to show the depths of Sirhan's mental illness, so he decided to prod Sirhan into an anti-Zionist diatribe in front of the jury. And Sirhan became so vitriolic against both the State of Israel and Jews in general that his other lawyer, Emil Berman, who was Jewish, requested again to be taken off the case after his testimony. That was again denied. But the cross-examination by Lynn Compton of Sirhan was masterful. He forced Sirhan to admit to so many instances of documented intentions of killing Kennedy, especially revolving around June 5th, that the jury was ultimately left with no question. Sirhan planned and killed Robert Kennedy. He had a plan which he put together over a lot of time, and the fact that the plan ended with the death of Kennedy and did not include escaping was not an indicator of insanity. When Compton was asking Sirhan about killing Kennedy, at first he contradicted his direct testimony by saying he didn't know who killed Kennedy. But when Compton followed that question with, quote, "But you know he's dead, right?" end quote, the smirk that Sirhan let out more than sealed his fate. The judge caught it, the media caught it, and there's no question that the jury caught it. Sirhan was convicted of murder in the first degree for the death of Robert Kennedy and originally sentenced to death until California abolished the death penalty about 3 years later, at which point he received a sentence of life with the possibility of parole. He had been denied parole every time he had been up for it until just about a month ago, when for the first time ever, the Los Angeles County District Attorney, George Gascon, declined to oppose parole, and Sirhan was released. He's now 77 years old. In summation, Sirhan has the distinction of being considered by some to be the first jihadist to strike in American history. I have a lot of issues with the limited scope of the insanity defense, both on the state and federal level. I do not think it covers enough people who suffer from serious mental illness and whose crimes are a direct result of that illness. I am all in favor of expanding the language and the scope in a thoughtful and measured way. That being said, Sirhan did not kill Robert Kennedy because of mental illness. I think Lynn Compton and his team established fairly clearly that this was premeditated murder. Sirhan Sirhan was a young man searching for meaning. And unfortunately for probably the world, he found meaning by focusing his anger towards a man whose most offensive trait was that he supported the state of Israel. Grant Cooper did an exceptional job of making a case for diminished capacity with what he had to work with, and trust me, it's not always easy to represent people who hold such hateful views, but that's part of the job, and you have to defend people who are truly awful, just like you would defend your best friend or your family member. So that's the show for this week. Thanks again to Dan Townsend, my audio engineer, who makes me sound better and better every week. A special congratulations to Brandon Rincon on his upcoming marriage to Arielle Weinstein. Very happy for you. Over the next few episodes, I intend to have another guest on. The response to the first episode with my colleague Bob Gottlieb discussing the Korematsu case on Japanese internment during World War II got a lot of positive feedback, so I'm going to bring on another host as soon as scheduling permits. I also have some requests for Organized Crime and Derek Chauvin and some other stuff coming through in the near future as well. If you have a case or a legal issue you'd like to have covered, you can send me an email at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can look me up the old-fashioned way through my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. I really appreciate everyone's continued support. I will keep making episodes as long as people enjoy them. So, if you do, I would appreciate it if you let me know. Until next time, as always, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks so much for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.